the night will snow. The winter hills are black, I'm all alone. Sitting in the back of a long white Cadillac. The headlights shine, the highway feels too black, I'll take my time. In a long white Cadillac, in a long.
That was Long White Cadillac by The Blasters, featuring Dave Alvin on guitar. That song comes from their 1983 album Nonfiction, their third album overall and their second for Slash Records. When that album came out, Slash had signed a distribution deal with Warner Brothers, which meant that a bunch of great LA bands, including The Blasters and X and The Gun Club and even Fear, were getting their albums into stores all across the country. The Blasters actually got a pretty decent push between 1983 and 1985. They got their own TV special, which we're going to talk about in this episode, and they were featured in the Walter Hill movie Streets of Fire, playing two songs on camera. They never quite broke through commercially, though, and in 1986, Dave Alvin left the band. He and his brother Phil, the singer, each made solo albums, and Phil kept the band going off and on while Dave embarked on a solo career. Dave Alvin is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the Osiris Network. If you enjoy the show, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to create more and better content, so become a subscriber if you can. This episode of the show is sponsored by Harry's Men's Grooming Products. I first told you about these razors on the last episode, and I'm still using them, and I'm still impressed as hell by them. I'm not a particularly high-maintenance guy. I shave once a week on Monday mornings, but I can't believe the job this razor does on my face. Monday and Tuesday, my face feels like a third grader's, and by Friday and even on the weekend, I am, I would say, about 50% less stubbly than I was when I was using my previous razors. What Harry sent me to test out was a shaving kit that includes a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade, and a really heavy, durable handle that honestly took a little getting used to. It's like writing with a really quality fountain pen compared to a regular ballpoint pen. That's what holding a Harry's razor feels like in your hand compared to a Gillette or a Bic disposable razor. Anyway, the kit that I got includes three of these five-blade heads, a can of shaving gel, and some post-shave balm to soothe your skin afterwards, supposedly. I never did use the post-shave balm, but I think the shaving gel has made my face smoother, which, you know, is nice. I mean, I'm not one of those guys who looks like a baseball glove. I didn't spend a whole lot of time in the sun getting barbecued even before we all went into quarantine, but even I can tell the difference. This is a real deal. So join the 10 million who have tried Harry's and claim your special trial offer by going to harrys.com/burning. Harry's provides quality, durable blades at a fair price, just $2 a blade. They manufacture the blades in their German blade factory that's been honing precision razor blades for a century, so you get incredibly high-quality blades at factory-direct prices, and it's super convenient, especially in these days of home confinement. Blade refills are delivered directly to your front door on your schedule, with or without a subscription. And there's a 100% guarantee, so if you don't love your shave, let them know and they'll give you a full refund. Also, they set aside 1% of the proceeds for nonprofit organizations devoted to helping provide better access to better healthcare for men and veterans. If you're listening to this, like I said, you can get a Harry's trial set at harrys.com/burning. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, a five-blade razor with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/burning to start shaving better today. Okay, so, Dave Alvin. I am incredibly excited that I got to talk to him. I first heard the Blasters 30 years ago in 1990. When a compilation called The Blasters Collection came out. I was into X, and I was into Dwight Yoakam, and I had heard Los Lobos, but I wasn't that big a fan of theirs, honestly. But anyway, I heard The Blasters, and I was just blown away. Their music was a mix of rockabilly, blues, country, a little bit of like mountain hillbilly music, and 40s jump blues and 50s R&B. They basically threw everything into a blender and somehow turned it into one thing, all driven by Dave Alvin's lead guitar and Bill Bateman's drums, which could really be a whole conversation on their own. Bateman hits harder on those albums than anybody short of, like, DJ Bonebreak from X. But Alvin is not just a nostalgia act. He's made close to 20 albums since leaving the Blasters, including a couple of reunion records with his brother Phil in the last few years. But he's also done a whole string of records with his band The Guilty Men. He's done some collaborations with country singer Jimmy Dale Gilmore and rockabilly singer Sonny Burgess, and a lot of other stuff. He's made guest appearances on a million things because he's a kick-ass guitar player with a unique style and sound that a lot of people want to use for things. And now, he's got a new band called The Third Mind, which was the impetus for this interview. They don't really sound like anything else he's done before. Their music is highly improvisatory psychedelic rock, with some touches of very early jazz rock fusion thrown in there, too. So, if you were wondering how a roots rock semi-traditionalist singer-songwriter winds up on this podcast, well, that's how. So, let's get into it. This conversation with Dave Alvin is really fascinating and goes down a lot of pathways I wasn't expecting. We talk about Robert Johnson, Miles Davis, Bob Dylan, Dick Dale, Sun Records, growing up in California. Dave Alvin is a hell of a sharp guy who knows a lot about music, and I had a fantastic time talking to him. I am going to play one more piece of music for you now. This is The Third Mind doing a version of Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satchidananda. So now you see what I mean about this not being his usual thing. And also you probably understand why I wanted to talk to him finally after being a fan for 30 years. So listen to some of that, and right afterward you'll hear my interview with Dave Alvin. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, Mr. Alvin.
This is him.
Hey, Phil Freeman. How are you, sir?
Hey, Phil. I'm so-so. I'm okay.
I understand that you were quite ill back in like February, which is why this interview kind of got kicked down the road.
Yeah, I'm still ill, which is a drag. I was in the hospital for about 9 days, and I was at the doctor's yesterday, and I apparently picked up everything's fine, you know, all my vitals and everything, you know, which were terrible, you know, when I went in, I was dying basically, and everything's fine, except I apparently caught a secondary infection in the hospital, as is common these days. So, yeah, it's just like, so now I got to deal with that. So it delays my, I'm not going to be climbing Mount Everest in the next few weeks. Anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah. So on to other more enjoyable topics.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess there's a million things I want to talk to you about, because I mean, I've been a fan for 30 years this year, because I became a fan in 1990 when the Blasters Collection was put out, that single CD, which came out when I was a senior in high school. And I already was listening to X, and I was already listening to Dwight Yoakam, so you guys were kind of the third leg of the stool.
Yeah.
In a way. it all kind of clicked, and I was like, wow, this, you know, there's something here, you know?
Yeah.
But your album, your new record, though, is The Third Mind, is very, very different from anything I've ever heard from you. So how did that lineup come together, and why did you choose the people that you did and stuff like that? Like, take me inside this project.
Well, it's different than most things that I've done. The Third Mind, I can, you know, there's some obscure things that I've done over the years. You know, instrumental things that I did for movies or stuff like that, that were closer maybe to the Third Mind. But as far as my own records, yeah, it's different because normally when you don't have huge budgets, you got to go in and, you know, hey, I've got, you know, 8 songs, and we've got 3 days. Let's get them. You know what I mean? And you leave some room, or I leave some room in those 8 songs for chance. And, you know, maybe the bass player is going to come up with a great line, you know. So there's always been elements in my, particularly in my solo work, of we don't know what's going to happen, you know. Right. In this section, and that's carried through into my live shows, things like that. There are things, sections in each live show where I'm playing usually a similar collection of songs every night, but there are parts of the show where it's like we don't have an ending for this, we'll figure it out when we get there. The difference with The Third Mind is there are some songs, you know, Morning Dew or The Dolphins or whatever, and but we don't know how we're going to play them, you know. So it's sort of the opposite. It's not like, well, there's sections of these songs that we don't know what we're going to do. Now this is the whole song. Well, we're not quite sure how we're going to handle this. And that was, for me, the fun part. You know, there was no rehearsals. There was the only thing that we would agree on was the key, you know, and that was it. And there was, you know, I think on the song Claudia Cardinale, the only, we were trying something, and then we stopped and said, okay, we're near something, but we're not getting it. Let's come up with an actual chord structure. That was the only like bit of like, okay, let's, you know, but the chord structure took, you know, 5 minutes at the most. And then I just told the musicians, I said, okay, let's just pretend you're on the beach in 1966 in Italy with Claudia Cardinale. What would that sound like? You know, and she's wearing a bathing suit, and it's a beautiful warm day, and then we cut it, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was as much arranging as we did on anything on the record. Everything was, you know, we would do four. I don't even think any of the songs got the five takes. You know, we just would go and listen to each other and play, you know. Yeah. And I'd always wanted to do that, you know, without getting too long-winded. I had read this book back in the, I think in the 90s, called So What? And it was written by a guy named John Sved. And it was a biography of Miles Davis, but it went into detail on his recording techniques with Teo Macero, who was his producer mm-hmm. for many years. And I remember being incredibly jealous because sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes Miles would do this, he and Teo Macero would do this trick where, like with Bitches Brew and all that, where they would go in, you know, they'd get Herbie Hancock and Tony Williams and whomever, you know, John McLaughlin and whomever, and then just they'd record for a week, you know, and then Miles and Teo Macero would then take those tapes and edit them into compositions. And I just thought, boy, that's great. You don't have to worry about words. You don't have to worry about getting on the radio. You don't have to worry about, you know, gee, is it too loud? Is it too quiet? Is it just, you know, and I just always had this fantasy of doing a record like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And most musicians don't have the luxury of the budgets, you know? And then there's also that thing of it's a way of recording that not a lot of musicians are comfortable with, you know. And most musicians, myself included, sometimes, you know, we want to know, or where am I going here in this bridge? You know what I mean? What do you want me to do? So the choice of of who was to play with on the record really boiled down to people that were willing and excited about the possibility of, okay, well, let's just go in and see what happens. Let's go in and not, you know, not know what we're going to do. You know, you got a free day, you know, let's just go goof around. And, you know, I'd known Victor Krummenacher for many years. I first met him in the mid 80s or so when he was just coming out with, you know, in Camper Van Beethoven. And so I'd known him over the years, and we always kind of, he had had the same kind of desire, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I'd been a fan of Michael Jerome, the drummer, for a long time. I had done some shows opening for Richard Thompson right after Michael had joined Richard Thompson's group, and I would watch the shows, and of course, you know, you're blown away by Richard Thompson's guitar talent. But on the other hand, I was spending most of the shows watching the drummer, you know, like, wow, man, that guy is such a great drummer. He can play anything, you know?
Yeah.
And so I you know, I always felt like, something will come along in, you know, in the future where he and I can work. And he was willing. And then the other guitar player, David Emmerich, I had known David when he was playing with Cracker and with Camper Van Beethoven, and then, you know, I knew he had gone on to work with Hyatt, John Hyatt, for years. So I knew he could play. You know, I knew he was real good, and I knew, you know, that his taste in music was very expansive. You know, mm-hmm. And because everybody's was. You know, I'm basically kind of a blues guy. It's how I play. But I like to take that sort of blues playing into as many different realms as possible, you know, whether I'm playing rhythm or whether I'm playing lead or, you know. And then all these guys come from slightly different backgrounds and disciplines. And that's always, that always interests me. You know, I don't necessarily want to play with another guitar player that plays like me. because then we both wind up sounding like each other, you know.
Yeah. How did you you mentioned being fundamentally a blues player, so I mean, how did mm-hmm. you first become interested in like rockabilly and jump blues and country and all the music that you've made your career out of?
Well, everything, if you, you know, the old story, if you, you know, you stretch it back to a certain point, everything is based on blues, you know. And when I say that, when I say blues in this grand sense, I'm referring to the scale and the form, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when Louis Armstrong was doing the Hot Fives and the Hot Sevens, about half the stuff was blues. And it was geared towards the black, you know, African-American blues market, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the same way that, say, a Blind Lemon Jefferson record was, or a Bessie Smith record was, you know. And so when I was a kid and I was collecting 78s with my brother Phil, you know, we started collecting as sort of blues purists, you know. Mm-hmm. But then the more you learn about the blues, the more you learn that it's like it's in everything just about. And so when I listen to certain types of music, my brain always goes to, okay, where is the blues in this, you know? And so you can find it, you know, you can listen to a man that's, you know, called the grandfather of country music is Jimmy Rogers, who is, you know, in my opinion, he was just the first great white blues singer, you know, because more than half of his material was in the blues form.
Yeah.
You know, and then all the white guys that imitated him and came after him, you know, they were imitating a white guy singing, you know, blues. And so Ernest Tubb and all that, and Hank Williams and all that they all got influenced by the blues to a greater or lesser extent due to Jimmy Rogers, you know. Mm-hmm. So when I hear things like you know, say Western swing and all that, you hear the jazz and you hear the blues influence. It's just, you know, they're doing everything from you know, they're trying to do you know, maybe a Benny Moten song, you know, Kansas City big band jazz from the early 30s, and then they're also trying to do a Mississippi Sheiks number from, you know, the great Mississippi blues combo, the Mississippi Sheiks from the late 20s, early 30s.
I read a fascinating book some years ago by Elijah Wald called Escaping uh-huh. the Delta.
Yeah.
And it was a book about Robert Johnson, but mm-hmm. it talked about how the stuff that he recorded, the stuff that survived and made him the quote-unquote king of the blues in, you know, when he was rediscovered in the 60s and everything, that was the stuff that he recorded. But then when you read accounts of his live shows, he would play show tunes, or he would play country songs, or he would play basically whatever an audience seemed to be into. You know, he was a showbiz pro. He wasn't some demon haunted guy like they portrayed him as being when they were writing liner notes, you know?
Yeah. You know, the mythology, you know, what's the old saying, you know, if the myth is better than the truth, print the myth.
Yeah,
you know?
And I feel like,
and that's just always been the case, you know. There was certainly a thing that happened, you know, even, you know, a decade before Robert Johnson came around, where, you know, there were guys, say, you know, Blind Willie McTell, or, you know, or even Blind Lemon Jefferson, you know, that, yeah, they had a more extensive repertoire than, say, what the field recording guys were interested in, mm-hmm. you know. And so they were, you know, artists, black artists, were kind of, you know, not all, but some, yeah, were certainly pointed in the direction of, well, we're just looking for blues, or we're just looking for spirituals, or we're just looking for, you know, we're just looking for murder ballads, you know, which would be the sort of thing they'd say to a white act, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
You know, we already got guys doing fiddle tunes, so you got anything about a guy killing his family, you know, you know what I mean? So yeah, there are all those sort of decisions made, which are, you know, similar A&R decisions that went on, you know, for decades after. We don't really hear you doing Broadway, you know. Muddy Waters. I just don't see Muddy Waters on Broadway.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also think that some of that stuff is also, you know, I think that the genius, Robert Johnson's genius, on him in particular, was his ability to synthesize a lot of different blues styles, where he was certainly a master of Delta style blues. He was also a master or a student of more urbane blues, like Lonnie Johnson, you know, who was a blues slash jazz player, you know. Mm-hmm. and so he was able to bring all those elements together, you know, Lonnie Johnson, Petey Wheatstraw, even Skip James. He was able to bring all those disparate elements together and make them into a sound. So in that way, you know, Robert Johnson is very similar to what, say, Bob Dylan later did, you know, by mixing the blues with Woody Guthrie and the folk songs and you know, country music and early rock and roll. So,
yeah,
you know.
Now, did that... Because the thing is, when I listen to the Blasters records, I hear mm-hmm. that same kind of synthesis going on. Like, there's country stuff, there's rockabilly stuff, there's bluesy, mm-hmm. there's strutting bluesy stuff. You mm-hmm. know, there's a broad range of covers. So was that the attitude that you started with? Was that kind of, you know, pulling from
yeah.
your time as record collectors? Like, okay, we're going to do
yeah.
a bunch of different things and make it all one thing.
Yeah. That's exactly what it was, because my brother had had a blues band since he was about 13 years old, and when he was like 13, the blues they were playing was you know, English style, you know, because of the guys in the neighborhood were all into, you know, Eric Clapton or Jeff Beck or whomever. And but then that quickly changed the more, you know, we started collecting records and hearing the real stuff. It then morphed into, you know, by the time I was like 16, he had a straight up, you know, Chicago blues band, you know, and there were no long solos, there were no, you know, everything, it was cut and dried. It was, you know, it was like, it sounded just like a Chess record, you know. And so in a way, you know, for him, he always had a strong voice, and he always, Phil always had a unique voice. And it was finding, oh, I'm getting off track here. For me, the thing about the Blasters was, you know, so you got these guys, we get together and we're basically a pretty rock and blues band. We play things pretty fast, faster than normal, and we were playing things louder than normal. And how do you write songs for it, you know, that mm-hmm. are that don't sound polarly opposite of the stuff you're you know, like an original now. No, please don't play an original. You know? And so I had to write songs that sounded like, well, you know, maybe Willie Dixon wrote it, or maybe Carl Perkins wrote it, or maybe Chuck Berry wrote it. And my idea was, yeah, all these musics are connected. You know, rockabilly is a, you know, is a form of blues, you know, half a rockabilly material is in a blues form, you know. Carl Perkins may not have been laying around the house listening to Blind Lemon Jefferson records, but, you know, culturally, he certainly knew what the blues was. He certainly heard it on the radio stations, as did Elvis, and they knew who Wynonie Harris was, and they knew who, you know, Lightnin' Hopkins was, you know, and so, you know, to add rockabilly into a blues band was really easy, you know, because it also reflected that we liked to rock, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, and you could take a Magic Sam song like 21 Days in Jail, and that Willie Dixon produced, and that's a rockabilly song. It's just done by a Chicago blues guy, you know, but it's a blues song, you know, structurally. So my idea as a songwriter was just, okay, let's see how far we can take this. And so you know, with a song like one of our most famous songs, a song called Marie Marie, and my idea for that really boiled down to just what if Chuck Berry had written a song with the Balfour Brothers, who were a great Cajun, you know, family band, acoustic family band that played traditional Cajun music, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was the idea, you know, and it wasn't that far away from blues, you know, you know, and it worked out that way with just about everything I wrote for the band was, you know, what are they comfortable playing and how can I mix in a, you know, say a Chicago blues kind of verse feel and then make the chorus, you know, maybe the chorus is a George Jones feel. You know, who knows, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because, it's, I mean, obviously Chuck Berry is the fountain from which so much stuff springs, but it's funny because I was thinking about actual guitar styles when I was, you know, prepping for this interview, mm-hmm. and, like, I feel like Billy Zoom is obviously just a huge, you know, devotee of Chuck Berry. I mean, on Johnny Hit and Run Pauline, he plays the Chuck Berry fanfare to start the song, you know? But you, when I listen to your playing, I almost hear something more like Cliff Gallup from Gene Vincent's band, like a little bit, like a little bit cleaner, you know.
Oh, I wish, man. I wish. My style is kind of based on. I have a couple of quirks. My musical hero, growing up, and really still to this day, is a tenor sax player named Lee Allen. Who had played all the, he was a member of the Blasters, and we had known him, I'd known Lee since I was about 13 years old. And Lee had moved, he'd lived in New Orleans in the 50s and played the tenor sax solos on all the great Fats Domino and Little Richard records, and, as well as countless others, you know, Come On Baby, Let the Good Times Roll by Shirley and Lee, and people like that, you know, mm-hmm. Professor Longhair records, Rory Brown records, you know, Smiley Lewis records. He was the lead tenor guy, you know, in the Dave Bartholomew band. And because of that, I do, and maybe this is where you could say there's some Cliff Gallup running around in there, is I tend to do horn lines a lot.
Mm.
And most guitar players don't do horn lines. And sometimes, you know, let's say you're at a jam session or something, particularly in a blues jam situation, most guitar players, you know, well, these days they all want to sound a certain way. They want to sound like one of the Vaughn brothers or something, and they're not playing horn lines, you know. And so what I figured out many, many years ago is if you want to sound slightly different, throw in some horn lines, you know, take what Lee was doing, or take what some, you know, what the horns were doing on a Count Basie record in 1941. And that stuff just soaked into me, you know, and it helped that I had been a horn player when I was very young. I tried to play the saxophone. And so I always kind of had a willingness to, you know, listen to the melodies of the horns as opposed to just the groove playing behind the horn, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of my things, and that's stayed consistent throughout my career as a guitar player. Is, you know, I don't really, the guitar players that I lean towards are pretty across the spectrum, you know. I love, there's a guitar player, maybe some of your listeners know, the name Johnny Guitar Watson. I just love him. You know, his early stuff was blues and R&B, and then later in life, in his long career, he was playing funk. He was one of the funkiest funk guys ever. But what he was doing on guitar was the exact same guitar licks he was doing back when he was cutting straight blues in the early mid 50s.
Yeah.
And he's always been a hero of mine. Hendrix, of course, you know, when I was 13, I got to see Jimi Hendrix twice live, and that just, you know, changed my life to where I never wanted to play like Jimi Hendrix, you know,
mm-hmm.
because that's approachable. But, you know, certainly times in my live shows where it's like, oh, maybe a little bit, you know, let's do a little bit. And then in the third mind, there's a little bit of Jimmy coming into the third mind, you know. People like, you know, of course, Chuck Berry and Carl Perkins and lesser known, say, rockabilly players. I was always a big fan of Roland Chains, who was the guitar player on all the Jerry Lee Lewis Sun records, you know. A sweet man and a good guy. I just, you know, I'm not a huge fan of guitar technique, you know, because it kind of bores me after a while. Mm-hmm. But I like guitar characters, personalities. Like the other night here in our quarantine shutdown, I got kind of swept down a long, wonderful, nice passage listening to a current guitar player named sort of traditional jazz guitar player-ish guy named Frank Vignola. Mm-hmm. And the guys that he was playing with, I watch a lot of duets, and they're all great guitar players, you know. And everybody's kind of working in a semi-Django Reinhardt kind of style. But then Vignola had all this sense of humor, and he had these beautiful melodic lines, and he just, you know, it's just like, I was like, that is currently now my favorite guitar player is this guy, you know, because he's got a little bit of a goofball in him, and a little bit of a curveball pitcher, you know. He was doing some solo on a piece with like Wynton Marsalis and all these heavyweights, and he pulled out the guitar lead from Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and the Comets. And I just thought, this guy's great, you know. Not only can he play like Django, he can make jokes about it too. And so that kind of stuff interests me in guitar players. And, you know, I like guitar players that the ones that really influence me are the ones that sound like themselves and no one else. On the third mind, there's, you know, I don't play an SG, Gibson SG, but I'm a big fan of John Cipollina. I love the fact that you can hear John Cipollina coming from 2 miles away. And John Cipollina was the one of the lead guitar players in the San Francisco band Quicksilver Messenger Service. Mm-hmm. And you know, you hear him, and I hear him play, and I just get like, wow, no one else played like that. You know, a lot of the early and middle period Michael Bloomfield, I'm a big fan of, because in that era, you know, nobody played like, you know, nobody was sounding like Michael Bloomfield. Not many people since have sounded like Michael Bloomfield. You know, even those of us who are, you know, his acolytes or whatever, you know, similar to the guy Vignola, you know, he had a sense of humor, and he had a sense of curveballs, you know. And I like musicians that throw curveballs, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Did that answer your question? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And so here, actually, it leads me to another question, because this is, you know, it sort of related to all of these things about, you know, things blending into each other, and, you know, it's all one mm-hmm. big musical thing. So given that there was really nothing punk about the Blasters at all, why do you think you guys wound up sort of connected to the LA punk scene, like signing to Slash and, you know, stuff like
that? I wouldn't say there was nothing at all, you know. We were certainly part of that scene. We certainly played louder and faster than average blues band. Mm-hmm. You know, and which was a blessing and a curse. It was a curse, and a lot of the blues purists, even to this day, kind of like look down on us a little bit, like, oh, they don't sound like Jimmy Page, or they don't sound like Eric Clapton, you know. Because that's these days, that's what blues purists are. they're not quite looking for Sunhouse and Skip James. They're looking for you know, who sounds the most like the first Fleetwood Mac album.
I just got to tell you this. Back in 2010, I went and saw Tom Petty when he did his blues rock album, Mojo. He came around on tour.
Oh, yeah.
And he had Buddy Guy opening for him. And
yeah.
Midway through the opening set, I saw the guy sitting in front of me Googling Buddy Guy on his phone.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, you've made a fan, you know, so
yeah.
Count that as a victory.
So, where were we? Yeah, boxing, so yeah. We were certainly, like I said, when we had to, especially when we were on bills with Black Flag or people like that, we certainly had to play louder and faster than everybody else. You couldn't have put up, you know, taking a local blues bar band, you know, and put them up in that situation, you know, and have them leave the gig alive. So, and we certainly, me in particular, I was very sympathetic and felt very much at home. I felt more at home in the punk rock scene than I did in most others, because in those days, in the early days in particular, it wasn't about, again, it wasn't about technique, you know. There were certainly guys that had technique, you know, you mentioned Billy Zoom. Billy had, you know, lots of technique. But in general, it was, who gives a shit, you know? Mm-hmm. Let's make noise. Let's have fun. Let's drink too much. Let's fall down. Let's get back up. Let's make more noise, you know? And that was the thing, you know? It didn't matter. If you listen to, you know, there are rockabilly records, let's say, in the 50s that were overly produced, or not negatively. You know, Gene Vincent's records were beautifully produced records, you know, that Don Nelson did. And there were Eddie Cochran's records, were amazingly, wonderfully produced records. You know, they're simple, but they're brilliant. You know, you listen to Summertime Blues, and that's all acoustic guitars and like a drum and a box, mm-hmm. you know. And that's just amazing that they could make that sound happen, you know. But then there are records that, say, Sam Phillips did, both his blues recordings in the early mid-50s and then his rockabilly recordings from the mid-50s onwards. That's just, there's mistakes all over the place, you know? It didn't matter, you know? I always loved Sam Phillips for that attitude of, it ain't the playing, it's the feel. And if you got the feel, then that's the important thing, their thing, you know?
Yeah.
And so all of that, you know, to me related to punk rock, you know, so what, the Cramps aren't the best musicians in the world. I'd rather hear the Cramps than hear some of the best musicians in the world. You know, that was my attitude. I'd rather hear sincerity than boredom, you know,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes when, let's say you got there's nothing worse than playing the blues with, say you got five people playing a blues song and just one of them's not into it. You know, all it takes is one and you've got a terrible, okay, well, that was fine, guys. You know, everyone has to be on the same page, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the reason why, say, the early or even later Rolling Stone stuff is so great, is they were all roughly on the same page. Okay, got it. We're all here. Let's go. You know, the Muddy Waters records from the early 50s are so great because everybody's on the same page, you know. And then you know, so you, I'm not answering the question, but that's, you know, it was that thing about you know, technique doesn't matter, it's the feel, it's the community. You know, to me, punk rock was, in the early days, was about a community, and it was about being free to do whatever the hell you wanted to do. And of course, that changed, you know, rather quickly after a while, into punk rock becoming, you know, a cookie cutter sort of thing. You had to sound like this band if yeah. you're going to be considered punk rock. And then when that happened, I just lost all interest, you know. I was back to listening to Lightning Hopkins, you know. I was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Tell me about the TV special that you guys did with Carl Perkins and Willie Dixon. I found that on YouTube. Where did that originally air? Like, what happened? What was the deal?
That was a show that was on on PBS called Soundstage, and it was I think it was on every month, you know, sort of like Austin City Limits,
or,
you know, every couple of weeks, and they would have everybody from, you know, young Tom Waits to, you know, whomever, you know, Steve Goodman and John Prine, you know, those kind of things, or they'd have cabaret singers, you know, or jazz singers, and yeah, they just came to us, said we want to do, you know, a show with you guys, and we were of course familiar with the show, and they said you could have whoever you wanted, and so we just kind of threw out some names, and because they filmed it in Chicago, it was like, well, you know, let's see who we can get, you know. And Willie Dixon was a huge influence on me as a songwriter, so it was like, let's get Willie Dixon. And then Carl Perkins was available, and that was like, there's my two, you know, there's two aspects of my songwriting right there. Let's get those guys. And so yeah, we spent two nights in Chicago filming it, and somewhere, you know, the first night was us with, you know, we did our show, and then in the middle we brought up Willie Dixon, and we did about four songs with Willie. And I think in the show itself they only used one of the songs. And then with Carl Perkins, you know, it was the second night. Carl and his band went up and played, and then we went out and did our set. And then afterwards, then we all got together. And on the show, they only used one of the songs that we all did together. But there are, I know, there's, like I said, there's two or three songs of Willie that are sitting in a can somewhere with Willie Dixon, and then there's about eight songs with Carl Perkins that are sitting in a can somewhere. Those I would love to hear. And when I run into guys, you know, because there were guys out there that somehow managed to find things, you know, that they shouldn't have, you know. And when I run into guys like that, that's, you know, there's two holy grails. There's the sessions I did with Bob Dylan, and then there's, which have never come out on anything. And then there's the soundstage stuff. It's like, I would love to hear those, you know, a couple of other songs with Willie Dixon, and I'd love to hear the eight, seven or eight songs with Carl Perkins with us backing him up that were just no nonsense. It was a Sun Records thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I'd never even heard about the Dylan thing, but I know people that for years have been hoping and praying that more tapes will come out of Dylan with the guys from the Plugs as his band.
Yeah. With Charlie and Tony. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause they did that one Letterman appearance, and that was it. You know, nothing else ever happened with it.
Yeah. Tony played with them for a little while, and I know Charlie played with them for a little while. I think independent of each other, but I think that, you know, he said the funniest thing to me, because I did the sessions right after I left the Blasters, and we had met previously, and he was a Blaster fan, which, you know, that's great, you know. But he, we spent about 13 hours in the studio, we recorded everything from Elmore James to you know, Muddy Waters, to we even did a rockabilly song, a Johnny Carroll rockabilly song called Rock With Me Baby, and we did a couple of spiritual numbers. We did Samson and Delilah and something else, and but we also did You'll Never Walk Alone by Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Wow.
Yeah. Which, trust me, I needed a chart for that one. So it was all over the place, you know. And but about 6 months later after the sessions, or maybe a year later, I don't know. I went to see Bob Dylan play, and I got invited backstage. And so we're talking, and he said the greatest self-aware line I think I've ever heard. He said, yeah, sorry we didn't use any of that stuff that we cut. I said, that's all right, Bob, your record, do with it, you know. And he goes, yeah, it'll come out one of these days. And then there's this pause, and he goes, on one of those box sets. I was like, you got it, man.
Yeah.
But somebody tracked down, we did a version of a Slim Harpo song called Got Love If You Want It. And it was just like this stray recording, and I'm almost, I'm 99% sure that that's me, you know, because whoever the guitar player is, he's making the same mistakes I would have made, you know. So I'm like, oh, that's probably me right there. So anyway, yeah. So you know, there's a lot of things floating around from, you know, the past that I would love to find. There's a, you know, there was a time when Lux Interior from the Cramps joined the Blasters on stage and sang a song with us. I would love to have that, you know.
I had the record that you made with Sonny Burgess, and
yeah,
one of the things I love about that record is that it sounds like it took about as long to record as it does to listen to. So I mean, tell me the story behind that record.
Well, there was absolutely no budget. You know, High Tone Records, who I was signed with at the time, you know, were, when I asked them if I could, you know, if they would put out, or if I managed to do a record with Sonny Burgess, could they put it out? And they said, yeah, but they weren't going to pay a lot. And for a few reasons, because the backup band was a guy, belonged to a guy named Jack Smith, who had, they were called the Rockabilly Planet, and they were out in Rhode Island. And they had a great guitar player named Jerry Miller, who plays with, what is her name now? Oh, just walked out. Elin Jewell, great singer-songwriter. He plays with her now. But so I knew the band would be okay. And I'd met Sonny and played a little with Sonny, so I knew Sonny would be great. But we had the situation of, we had no money. We had to record and mix in like 3 days, you know.
Yeah.
So you just go in and get what you can while you can do it. And you know, and it's also one of those things of, you know, do you need a 50 minute Sonny Burgess record? I don't know. You know, it felt right, you know.
Yeah, his Sun singles are so unique, because I mean, nobody had a trumpet player. And you know,
yeah,
at that point, you know, it was just like, really, you're gonna keep the trumpet player? Okay.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that was intentional. They wanted to be different, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted a different sound, and everybody had a, you know, sax player, so they figured, well, let's get a trumpet player. And the guy was just kind of, you know, Ray Nance, I believe was his name, and who wound up working later in life for Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5. He kind of took it on himself to just to learn a couple notes on trumpet. And
so that wasn't his primary instrument? He was
Jack Nance? I don't think so, no.
Ah, okay. So that's kind of like the ZZ Top record, the album De Gayo that they made in 79, where they had horn section on two or three songs, and so Billy and Dusty learned enough on those horns that they could play the parts themselves, because they had a rule that no outside musicians on ZZ Top albums.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, well, you know, the my favorite story of the Sonny Burgess record was, we only put the trumpet on one song. We did a cover of a big Joe Turner jump blues number called I Don't Dig It. And you know, and I wanted to have the trumpet on a song. So, but I didn't know any trumpet players in Warwick, Rhode Island, you know? And so finally we tracked down a guy who was like the band leader at a local high school. And this guy could really play the trumpet, you know? And he came down and we put up the track, because he was an overdub, and played the track for him, and he starts blowing, man. You know, he was beyond, you know, Dizzy Gillespie. He was out in Maynard Ferguson land, you know. And
wow.
I finally had to go out in the studio and say, look, you know, we're kind of stressing you know, this ain't a jazz record. There's kind of, we're stressing naivete here. So maybe play like one of your students, you know? He's like, oh, okay. So then I go back into the control room and run the take again. And he's not quite as explosive, but he's still pretty good, you know? Da-da-da, 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 you know? And I went back out and I said, I tell you what, how about one or two notes only? And he looked at me, and then I just said, don't worry, I won't put your name on the record. He goes, okay, thanks. And then he was fine. Then he knew exactly what to do. And it sounded like a Sonny Burgess record.
Yeah.
But, you know, those Sonny Burgess records on Sun were the epitome of the Sam Phillips ethos of, you know, that's got the feel. That has nothing to do with... you know, with technique or anything. It's all about the spirit inside the groove. And that's one of the reasons, you know, I always, when I listen to, you know, my favorite sort of, you know, I have certain favorite record labels, and of course Sun is one of them. And, but what I love about Sun Records is that Sam Phillips, you know, oops, I messed up. Oh, you're putting it out anyway. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So you had a pretty steady band throughout the 90s, like whether they were referred to as the Guilty Men or not. So how did that band, sort of that crowd of guys, come together, and what did they bring you that you were looking for?
Well, I always look for, again, going back to that thing about if there's one guy that's bored, you're sunk. You know, if there's one guy on stage looking at his watch, you know. And so I've always chosen musicians that have a certain kind of spunk to them, you know. I like playing with musicians that have similar roots as me, but not necessarily the same, you know, because I had that with the Blasters. We did that, you know, and that was great. Now I want to try this. You know, as a self-taught musician, you know, I always want to learn from other musicians. You know, I'm constantly learning. And so I want to play with guys or gals that can teach me things. And so in my own band, yeah, I want to have a band that's able to at least, you know, competently pull off a blues song, if that's what I call. And I'd like a band that if I'm in the mood to sing or play a country song, they can pull that off. And or a rockabilly song or whatever, you know, or one of my songs, you know, because it helps to have a backing in all those to play my songs. And I've been really fortunate. I've always, you know, starting with the Blasters and until now, you know, I've always played with musicians that were better than me, and I'm always learning. And you know, when I detect boredom in a player, that, you know, then our time together is not long, you know, because I don't want to bore anybody. I want, you know, I'm always trying to play up to the situation and not play down to it, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. Like if you know, if you have guys playing, if you take a guy that's, you know, way into, let's say, jazz fusion, and tell him to, you know, we're going to do this little folk song here. He, you know, he's either going to get it and get it really well, or he's just going to be so bored. Man, there's only three chords here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, anyway, I like musicians that can play a lot of different styles and are easy to travel with and all that kind of stuff. So throughout the, I mean, not just the 90s, I mean, it's been throughout the, you know, 90s, the aughts, and now the teens, you know, I'm just always, that's been my goal. You know, I like, you know, if I could get a good blues bass player, a solid bass player that likes playing the blues, then I'm happy. If I get a good drummer that can, you know, cover, make enough noise and be creative enough to cover up all my mistakes, I'm really happy, you know. And the same goes with guitar players. If I can find a guy that knows about certain obscure blues players and yet can also play like certain obscure country players, I'm happy. You know, like my guitar player Chris Miller, you know, he can he can sound like any Bakersfield guy. He can sound like Roy Nichols or, you know, anyone like that. And then he can, or Don Rich, but then he can also sound like the very obscure Houston blues player, Hop Wilson, you know? And I like that. You know, so that means if I get the urge to call a Hop Wilson song, I can do it.
You
know?
Yeah.
And so that's always been what keeps me, you know, what I look for in musicians to play with, or, you know, just who can I learn from, you know? And in the case of like the Third Mind, I'm learning from all those guys, you know? So.
Yeah. It's funny that that version of Journey in Satchitananda that opens the record, like,
mm-hmm.
It's psychedelic sort of, but then it reminds me of Dick Dale in a way, the intro. And,
yeah.
And I'll tell you something. I went and saw him in early 90s, I guess, when that album Tribal Thunder came out. And mm-hmm. I saw him at this club in Hoboken called Maxwell's. I don't know if you remember that place.
Oh, I know it very well. Yeah.
That might be the loudest show I ever went to.
Yeah.
I mean, Dick Dale, he had two drummers, and mm-hmm. it was literally like tidal waves coming off the stage. It was just a monster sound. And so
yeah.
I mean, I'm always kind of impressed by, you know, by that kind of thing, especially for a guy, you know, who was at his age at that point, you know. And so.
Yeah, which is probably my age now. excuse me. Yeah, I did a session with Dick Dale. It was hilarious. And we got along great. I didn't think we would. But he was really, you know, I don't know if I'd want to go camping with him, but I really enjoyed him. When we spent, you know, we cut the track. And the guy, there's a friend of mine, is a guy named Stanley Wyckoff, and he did this album under the name Bierce in L.A. And I had done a couple of his other albums, and he always managed to get great musicians like Nicky Hopkins and Jeff, or John Jorgensen, and people like that to play on his records, and I'd play on them. And he talked Dick Dale into doing a track. And so Dick and I are at the studio, and we're talking and trying to figure out, well, who'll take what solo here? We'll do that. Da, da, da. And Dick finally says, I can't play rhythm guitar. I said, really? He goes, yeah. Do you mind? Can you handle rhythm? And I'll just do the Dick Dale stuff. And I was like, it's fine by me. And I love that. I can't play rhythm. I'm really a trumpet player, which is true. It's what he started out as, was a trumpet player mm-hmm. who, when rock and roll started coming along, realized, hey, I could maybe make some more money if I play guitar. And, you know, if you listen to some of his records, he's a fine rhythm guitar player, but he really was kind of mild-mannered when you got down to it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so we spent like 2.5 hours talking about everything, you know, under the sun. And he had like a compound out in the Mojave Deserts. And so he says to me, we're chatting away, and at the end he goes, Dave, you know, I got this place. I got this compound out in the desert. You should come out and visit. Just, I got my own landing strip. You can fly your own plane over there. And I was like, I'll get right on that, Dick. I'll start taking flying lessons right now and just go out and buy a plane. Just come visit you. You're a funny guy.
Where did you, I was going to ask you this much earlier in this conversation. Where did you grow up? Downey, California.
Where? Downey, California is about 15 miles southeast of downtown Los Angeles. And when I was a kid, Downey was it was transitioning from being orange groves and avocado groves and bean fields and people riding their horses down the street to being sort of mindless suburb of Southern California. So it changed as I was a kid, you know.
Okay, yeah, because my dad grew up in, which I thought that it was similar, but I guess it was very different, because my dad grew up in Fontana.
Oh, yeah. Like, no, Fontana,
like
well.
Which is more of like a desert town, I think.
Well, Fontana was a mixture of everything. It was a little bit of high desert. It was agricultural. It was a lot of grapes in Fontana. It actually used to be grape country, wine country. But it was also, Fontana was a steel town, and there was the big Kaiser Steel plant was in Fontana. And there's a song of mine on an album of mine called Ash Grove called Out of Control that talks about Fontana a lot.
Ah,
you know,
okay.
Yeah. My dad was a union organizer at that steel mill, and for the Steelworkers Union. And my brother worked there for a while. My brother Phil worked there for a while when he got out of high school. He worked in the slag heap there.
Wow. Yeah. And then
so I know Fontana well. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then years later, my grandpa moved to this little nothing town called Phelan, which is way out in the desert.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
A post office, basically. And yeah. I mean, he had this dirt road leading up to his house, which was on the top of a hill, and he wouldn't even fix it so that it would get all pitted out when there was rain and stuff. So if you didn't have a four-wheel drive, you couldn't even visit my grandpa. He was one of those California desert guys, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There's still a lot of those.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you about was the Flesh Eaters reunion. How did that come about? Because you guys hadn't played together or done anything for like 35 years, right? I mean,
no, we had done. We hadn't recorded an album or anything. We had done a tour. Oh man, we had done a West Coast tour somewhere in the. Oh God, I can't remember now. The Chris D would remember, but it was in the aughts. And there used to be this thing called All Tomorrow's Parties.
Mm-hmm.
There was like this festival, this English festival, where the festival organizers would ask somebody, you know, groovy and hip and cutting edge to be the curator, right? And then whoever that curator was would choose the acts. And one year, they chose this band Mudhoney.
Mm-hmm.
This would be around maybe 2001, maybe somewhere around in there. And Mudhoney had been very influenced by the Flesh Eaters. And they asked, hey, let's get the original Flesh Eaters. And they offered enough money that we all said, sure, you know, a trip to England. Yeah, sure. And money and going home with money. Wow, great. And so we did a West Coast tour to get ready for that. And it was fun, you know. But it was a bit of a throwback, you know. It was a bit of like, well, we're just playing the record and that's what we do because that's what we were. And it sounded fine and all that. But then about 3 years ago, we did a quick tour of the West Coast. And it was actually really, really, really good. And what was really nice was everyone kind of relaxed a little, and it didn't have to be just like the record that we had done called A Minute to Pray, A Second to Die. It could grow a little bit. And we added a couple of different songs and stuff. And it was also great that we were all still alive. You know, and I say that seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It's like some of us shouldn't be. and so it was kind of nice. And so we thought, well, after we did that tour, we thought, you know, hey, when we're all free, let's make a record just for the fun of it. And so then, yeah, about a year later, we had the time to make the record. And we went in and spent about a week making this record, you know. And then after the record was done, it was like, we should tour, you know. and we should go to where we never went before. You know, we should go to the East Coast. We should go to the Midwest and go to Texas and everything. And it somehow worked out financially that we could do it, you know. I think that the record we had done back in 81 or 82, I forget what year that was.
Yeah, I think it was 81. Yeah.
Yeah, 81. That was a pretty, uncommercial and yet oddly influential record, because it was when punk rock was becoming cookie cutter, and we had a marimba in the band, you know, and we had, you know, a saxophone and we had some songs that were kind of long, you know, and weren't all da 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 da. You know, we had some of those too, but, and so, for the next album, 80 years later, we let all our influences show, you know, and there's a couple of things I'm real proud of on that record. There's a thing called Ghost Cave Lament that's about 12 minutes long, that, you know, I'll be honest, there were a couple of guys in the band that were like, I don't play 12 minute songs, and and it took me and Christy, you know, to convince them to, yeah, just give it a shot, you know, just give it a shot. And I remember telling one of them, one of the two doubters, I said, look, just cut it once. You never have to fucking play the song again. Okay. And then, of course, it became the last song of our set every night on our tour. it was the way we ended every show because it was so dramatic and wonderful. And so we could bring everything that, you know, or bring a lot of the things that we had learned over the years into the Flesh Eaters, you know. And it could sound like the old Flesh Eaters, and yet it sounded like new Flesh Eaters, you know. And so, yeah, I'm real proud of a lot of that record, you know. And you know, you had mentioned earlier that a lot of the stuff that I've done over the years, none of it sounds really like the Third Mind. Well, some of that Flesh Eaters record kind of has a Third Mind feel to it, you know. There's a song on there, My Life to Live. Oh, The Youngest Profession. And that was just, Chris D had these lyrics and we just did it, you know, just, okay, it's a blues in whatever key it was, you know, do a one chord blues. And then you lead us, Chris, you tell us when to go crazy. And he did.
So that was kind of how it would go. Like the arrangements would be sort of loose and, you know, figuring it out
on some of the songs. Other songs we'd rehearsed mm-hmm. a lot. Because Chris doesn't play an instrument, and he comes up with a melody, and he and I co-wrote a couple of the songs on the record. We co-wrote the Ghost Cave, the 12-minute song, which is why I was laboring so hard to get it recorded. But we cut another one that we'd written on Black Temptation, and his songs, because he doesn't play an instrument, he's not. He modulates, you know, a lot. Uh-huh. And so some of the songs have got two or three modulations in them. And so you got to rehearse, you got to know those or you're lost.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Some of the songs were worked out way in advance, you know, but then other stuff. Yeah. Once you get the stuff that you know, rehearse heavily, then you could go in and say, okay, let's do this one now. Just wing it, you know. And everybody was in the right frame of mind, you know. As I said earlier, everybody was on the right page. Everybody was, you know, down with the program, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was my conversation with Dave Alvin, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us improve the website and the show. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.